States. Put this against what the U.S. is doing in the Caribbean, bombing so-called drug boats to prevent drugs from coming into the United States.
Again, have you no shame? Here's somebody who was essentially a drug kingpin, someone who used the authority of his office to ensure that drugs in massive quantities were brought into the United States. He is prosecuted, he is convicted, and he is sentenced. And what does President Trump do? He lets him out of jail. Meanwhile, fishermen on boats in the Caribbean, who we have never been tried or charged with anything, are shot and killed from the air. And when people are holding on for their lives, they follow through and shoot and kill those people. This is not about fighting to stop drugs from coming into this country, because then you would not see the pardon of somebody who was convicted for that offense. This is pure politics, and it is playing with people's lives, ending people's lives for partisan political advantage.
And David Cole, I'm wondering, Trump's use of the pardon. Most presidents wait till their final year in office, and around Christmas time they do a bunch of pardons. But Trump has been on a rampage with these pardons. Could you talk about what the message that this sends about presidential power?
Well, the pardon power is one power in the Constitution that was given to the president without check. We've generally relied on, you know, the principles of presidents to use it in wise ways, use it to dole out mercy in appropriate cases, not to award donors, not to award the kids of donors, not to award those who have violated laws in the same way Trump violated laws. Trump is abusing the pardon power as no president before ever has, and I hope no president afterward ever will again. But it really raises questions about giving the president absolute power. Absolute power corrupts, and President Trump has proved that with his use of the pardon power. He's pardoning people who do good to his business interests. He is essentially using it to line his pockets and to let people off who he identifies with, not to engage in any kind of principled grants of mercy.
David Cohen, we just have 30 seconds. The judge's finding, the U.S. attorneys that President Trump appointed, his personal attorneys, Alina Habba in New Jersey, Lindsey Halligan, finding that they are illegally serving, the significance of this.
Well, this is what happens when the president insists on hiring loyalists who can't get Senate confirmation, even from a Senate that the Republicans control. He instead tries to use these tricks, calling them interim, calling them acting, etc. And now two courts have held that kind of back-to-back appointment to avoid Senate confirmation is unconstitutional.
David Cole, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at the Georgetown University of Law Center, now a visiting professor at Columbia Law School. Former ACLU National Legal Director, will link to your piece. Mark Kelly is being investigated for telling the truth. When we come back, Senator Bernie Sanders and New York City Mayor Alexandria Mamdani join striking Starbucks workers on the picket line in Brooklyn. Back in 20 seconds.
Struggler
dollars performing at the Brooklyn Folk Festival in November. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Monday, New York Mayor Lexaron Mamdani, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, joined striking workers on a picket line outside a Starbucks in Brooklyn. The rally came shortly after New York City announced Starbucks had agreed to pay more than $35 million to some 15,000 workers in what's been called the largest worker protection settlement in New York City history. This is Orhan Mamdani, who will be sworn in as mayor January 1st.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
It is a pleasure to be here at a picket with Starbucks workers like the ones on my right and the ones on my left, workers who are braving the December cold and the much deeper chill of unfair labor practices in this city and across this country, and the fear that has come with that of union busting while they demand the better working conditions that they deserve. Yeah. Like so many working people across this city, these are not demands of greed. These are demands for decency. These are workers who are simply being asked to be treated with the respect that they deserve. They're being asked that their labor be repaid in a manner that allows them to build a dignified life. And I joined them because I want to do everything that I can to show my solidarity, but also because I know that far too often, the voices of everyday working people are not amplified with the volume that management so easily receives. So I want to share a few numbers with you here this afternoon, numbers that I hope will place this struggle into some sense of perspective. $36.2 billion. That is the amount of money that Starbucks made in revenue just last year. $95.8 million. That's the compensation package that Starbucks CEO Brian Nickel earned for 4 months of work last year. $6,666. That is how much times larger Nickel's pay was than the average Starbucks barista's salary. Yeah. 400. That is how many labor law violations the NLRB has found that Starbucks has committed. Yeah. 120. That's the amount of stores that are on strike, and 85, the number of cities that they are taking place in. Now, what these numbers show us are a two-pronged picture. On one side, corporate greed and self-enrichment at the cost of its own workers. And on the other, remarkable solidarity by those workers who have been exploited and mistreated time and time again. Solidarity, as much as we speak of it, we have to remember, is not an abstract concept. It is measured in picket lines, stood on in the rain and in the sleet. It is measured in rent payments that workers do not know if they will be able to meet. Childcare bills they do not know whether they will be able to afford. And it is measured in strangers who have never met one another, linking arms to fight for a shared goal and a fairer future. And I am proud to stand here alongside incredible elected officials at the city level, at the state level, and also to my left, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Because all of us are united in the belief that we must build a New York where every worker can live a life of decency. We must build a New York where our words do not ring hollow as we say that this is a union town. And we must build a New York where the workers who power it are able to afford to live in it. Thank you so much. And now, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, it is an honor for my wife and me to be here with you, to stand with striking Starbucks workers who are telling this company they are sick and tired of corporate greed and sick and tired of union busting. What the mayor-elect just pointed out is that what is happening here on this picket line is happening all over this country. We are living in an economy where the people on top have never, ever had it so good. You got one man owning more wealth than the bottom 52% of American households. And while the CEOs make unbelievable salaries, 60% of our people in Vermont, in New York City, all over this country are living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to pay the rent, struggling to pay for health care, struggling to put food on the table. And what Ron and I are dedicated to is creating a nation and an economy which works for all of us, not just the 1%.
That's right.
So I just want to thank the Starbucks workers for their courage here and around this country. We are going to prevail. Thank you very much.
You know, as I was walking in, Bernadette was asking me, when am I going to stop attending protests and be the mayor? And I said, technically, January 1st, I will be the mayor. But I also want to make a point, which is that when I become the mayor of this city, I'm going to continue to stand on picket lines with workers across the five boroughs. And I've said this to many of the unions that are here today, many of the rank and file, which is that we want to build an administration that is characterized by being there for workers every single step of the way. And sometimes in the fight for decency and dignity that workers are waging, their voices are drowned out. And when you are the mayor of New York City, you have with that a platform where you can speak about the hundreds of times that Starbucks has violated labor laws, a platform where you can speak about the fact that, yes, we celebrate what DCWP was able to accomplish in the largest ever settlement that has been won in this city, $28 million, and also that we will continue to commit funding both of a fiscal kind and also of our own sustained commitment in terms of the political will necessary to ensure that we hold these kinds of corporations accountable. Just before we take a question, since I know we have some friends here with us, if we can first have a round of applause for the Starbucks workers themselves. We have Kai Fritz on my left, Noor Hayat on my right, and we have so many workers who have inspired us every single day, and I just want to say thank you before we even start the Q&A portion of this.
Dora, can I ask a question about many of the workers in this city are immigrants. When you met with President Trump, did you get a concession from him around ICE raids and not moving into the city? And then I have a question for Bernie Sanders. And that question is, do you think if you succeed with your Fight Club and other senators, if you succeed with the Fight Club and other senators who support your mission to unseat the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, it will open up space for progressive candidates that represent what the two of you stand for today?
When I met with the president, I made very clear that these kinds of raids are cruel and inhumane, that they are raids that do nothing to serve the interests of public safety, and that my responsibility is to be the mayor to each and every person that calls this city their home, and that includes millions of immigrants, of which I am one. And I am proud that I will be the first immigrant mayor of this city in generations, and prouder still for the fact that I will live up to the statue that we have in our harbor and the ideals which we have long proclaimed as being those of this city, but which have too often been ones we do not actually enforce and celebrate on a daily basis. And that is who I will be as the mayor of this city.
In terms of what we're trying to do in the Senate, I think it is no great secret there are differences of opinion in the Democratic caucus in the Senate. I'm an independent, and I caucus with the Democrats. And the difference is really manifested right here in New York City in the mayor's race that just took place. In my view, Zohran Mamdani ran one of the great campaigns in the modern history of this country. He started off at 1%, and he won. And how did he win? He won because he put together tens and tens of thousands of volunteers who knocked on doors. He won because he had the guts to talk about the oligarchs and saying that when he was going to become mayor and when he will become mayor, he's going to stand with the workers here at Starbucks and workers all over this city. And what we are seeing in America right now, in congressional races and Senate races, you're seeing more and more candidates standing up exactly the same way that Zoran did. And they are standing up and saying that we need an economy that works for all. We're not going to let the billionaires get tax breaks while people lose their health insurance. We're going to raise the minimum wage to a living wage rather than a starvation wage. We're not going to be the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a human right, etc., etc. So you're seeing that evolve, and I think it's a good thing. And I think we have the grassroots of America behind us. What Zoran did inspired people all over this country, all over the world, and we're going to keep going forward in that direction.
So that's Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani speaking Monday as they joined striking Starbucks workers on a picket line in Brooklyn. At the rally, I questioned them, but also talked to workers and organizers on the picket line.
So my name is Gabriel Peary. I'm a shift supervisor in Belmore, Long Island. At Starbucks, I am usually running the floor and making sure that customers and my coworkers are all set. We are out here today to fight the company's unfair labor practices, as well as get them back to the bargaining table for a fair contract.
And what would that look like?
So that would look like them ending their unfair labor practices. Right now, we have 400 open lawsuits for labor practices, as well as 650 pending, including, but not limited to, the unguaranteed scheduling, the mistreatment of coworkers, trans and gay, and the unfair hourly wages, as well as like not guaranteed hours. Starbucks has not recognized any union in any shop in the 4 years that we have been organizing. So it's pretty scary not to have that done, and we're hopefully expecting that this is what gets them to come back to the table.
My name is Melanie Crivellis. I'm an organizer with New York City DSA, and you know, I think it's really powerful to have the mayor out here today. Just today, city workers recovered tens of millions of dollars to Starbucks workers who have been denied fair pay. And I think in a moment where people are really struggling to put food on the table, to buy presents for the holidays, it means a lot to recognize that people are putting, you know, their lives on the line every day, they're working every day, and they're not getting what they deserve.
Do you see that same 104,000 volunteers continuing to work and organize, and what would they do?
Absolutely. I'm hopeful that, you know, there's a strong movement that got Zoran into office in November, and I'm hopeful that we're going to keep that movement going. You know, I think it matters a lot that we had such a full house out here today in front of Starbucks, and he's activated tons of folks across the city and people across the country. So I think it's, you know, generating a lot of hope for folks who haven't had a lot of that this year.
I think having Zoran Mamdani definitely gives our chances a lot better. He has been very forward-thinking, and I'm excited to see what he does when his first day of, like, being the actual mayor starts.
Starbucks workers and organizers on the picket line in Brooklyn Monday, where they were joined by Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani. Special thanks to Sam Alkoff. On Thursday, there is a major protest planned in front of the Empire State Building from 1 to 3. The motto of the group is "No contract, no Starbucks." When we come back, President Trump cancels World AIDS Day commemorations while gutting AIDS healthcare across the globe. We'll go to Uganda. Stay with us. Sue performing at the Brooklyn Folk Festival in November. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Trump's gutted AIDS health care while ordering an end to commemorations of World AIDS Day, which is observed around the world Monday, December 1st. For more on this, we're joined by journalist Stephen Thrasher in Kampala, Uganda. But first, we want to go to a clip Stephen shared with us of one of many Kampala residents who congratulated incoming New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani after his election victory last month. Mamdani was born in Kampala.
Hello, my name is Tunawe Samson. I'm here in Uganda, Kampala. I would like to congratulate you, Hamdani, upon winning that seat of mayor in New York City. In Uganda here, we are very happy and grateful for this milestone you've made, and we understand that you will serve people genuinely from your heart as you have been promising. We trust you and we believe something will happen positive to everyone that makes New York City a better place for each and every person. No matter the problem, something can be done. Thank you. Now I'm done.
For more from Kampala, Uganda, we're joined by Stephen Thrasher, acclaimed journalist, author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. He's the inaugural Daniel Remberg Chair for Social Justice and Reporting at the McGill School of Journalism and a faculty member of Northwestern University's Institute of Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-being, working on a series called Global Stop Work Order about how the Trump administration's cuts are affecting LGBTQ plus health and HIV AIDS in Africa, Europe, the Middle East and North America. The series is supported by a Pulitzer Center Global Reporting Grant and the Fund for Investigative Journalism. He has a new piece for The Intercept with Afif Nasuli. It's called Trump Gutted AIDS Healthcare at the Worst Possible Time. If you can lay out what you found, Stephen, thanks for joining us from Uganda.
Thanks for having me, Amy. As you showed from that clip, Uganda is the home of Zoran Mamdani, who's been very good on LGBT issues. But Uganda is a very, very difficult place. They have a law called the AHA Act, which makes what, quote unquote, aggravated homosexuality punishable by death. And so it's extremely difficult to get LGBTQ people the health care that they need. And it's very difficult to deal with HIV AIDS. And the Trump administration has made it even worse because a lot of USAID money was being used to pay for outreach. And the things that we found so far is globally, here in Uganda, Afif has seen the same thing in the Middle East. I've seen it in South Africa as well, and in the United States, is that this is an immediate crisis of LGBTQ employment. There are people who have been harmed very immediately. People who are trans, who have been forced into off their medications and they experience body dysmorphia. Trans men might begin periods again. This is extremely distressing, causes depression and suicide. And there are people who've had advanced issues around AIDS that have died, unfortunately. But for the most part, HIV is a very slow acting virus. And so if somebody becomes infected at age 20, it might be 10 years before we know that they're sick. But that same 20-year-old who's losing their job right now are thrown into an immediate distress. And the Trump administration has really attacked LGBTQ employment around the world in the same way that the federal workforce has seen a huge disparate impact on Black women in the United States. That dynamic is playing out around the world because often the only kind of employment that LGBTQ people, especially trans women, can get is working in the healthcare sector, the kind of work that USAID supported, and they've been thrown out of jobs in devastating numbers over the last year.
And Steve, could you talk about some of the particular examples? You mentioned South Africa, also Lebanon, or what's been happening on the ground with these cuts?
So in South Africa, I met with a colleague who worked at an HIV prevention organization that went from a staff of 86 people to just 4 people. 95% of them were let go. And my colleague told me that that if I were to go on a gay meetup app called Grindr, that I would see many of his colleagues working there because they have nothing else to do. South Africa has 36% or so unemployment. for the general population, but it's well into the majority for LGBTQ people. And so these people have nothing else to do but sex work. And there's nothing wrong with sex work, but it's also a real tragedy that these are people who have been trained to do important work. They've been doing really important epidemiological work, public health work, going into communities where rates of HIV are very high, and now they have nothing to do. And maybe they can only do sex work or they're not doing anything at all. So that's been really disastrous. The person who, the clip that you showed, Samson at the beginning, he works with a group called Universal Love Alliance that I've gotten to shadow and volunteer a bit with. I'm a phlebotomist and helped out with lab tech work on an outreach we did. And we went to a place where we saw 200 sex workers, and we're able, and this is in Uganda, and we're able to give them all condoms and lubricants, which are in very short supply since USAID was cut off. And to put into perspective how necessary and how out of reach these things are, when Trump was when he was elected, that empowered the government Uganda to get even more regressive because they knew what was coming, and they saw the Trump administration as supporting a very moralist standpoint from the government. So they stopped the importation of lubricants because they said that that was being used for immoral sex, being used by sex workers and by homosexuals. And lubricants are very important to make sure that people have healthy sex, that there's not tearing, that condoms don't break. So that object has basically been barred from being poured into the government, and they don't manufacture it here. So it's very hard for people to get it. Condoms are also extremely expensive. A condom can cost 50 cents or $1. And I found in my outreach trips that I've gone on that sex workers are sometimes only making 50 cents or a dollar. So it's prohibitively expensive, and they're less likely then to be able to use condoms now that USAID money has been taken away. And on this outreach where we went and gave away these resources to 200 people, we also were able to test 86 people for HIV and a host of STIs. And for me, from the United States, this was an incredibly successful outreach to be able to reach so many people at once. We found 3 positive HIV cases, 6 inconclusive, and 77 that were negative. And most of those were negative. Yeah.
Steve, I hate to interrupt you, but we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about something closer to home. Northwestern University, your university on Friday announced a $75 million, a deal to pay $75 million to the federal government to settle allegations of anti-Semitism and to reverse all policies, implementing something called the Deering Meadow Agreement. Could you lay out what that is and your response to that for Northwestern to get back its more than $700 million in federal funding?
Yeah, it was a real travesty for Northwestern to do this. The students made a good faith agreement in really solid principles that the university has just rejected and kind of on Thanksgiving weekend shown how the United States government is known for breaking agreements with groups. But these two stories are actually quite connected. I was saying that there are ways that we could be giving more resources to help deal with HIV public health in the United States and around the world. Scientists at Northwestern University and other universities and U.S. pharmaceutical companies are making lots of money that that is dependent upon this kind of work that's being done. And so Northwestern is throwing away tens of millions of dollars. The money that was given for the LGBT chair that I hold has basically been wasted because I haven't been allowed to teach for 2 years. And it's a real tragedy to see how people around the world, LGBTQ people of color, usually have been doing really, really important work on behalf of U.S. universities, on behalf of the United States government. This isn't just aid. This is, payment for the ways that people are doing research and volunteering their bodies to be tested for medications. Meanwhile, back in the United States, a university like Northwestern is just throwing away tens of millions of dollars to a fascist regime.
We want to thank you, Stephen Thrasher, for joining us, author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. We'll link to your Intercept piece, Trump Gutted AIDS Healthcare at the Worst Possible Time. A belated happy birthday to Dina Guzder. On Thursday, December 4th, I'll be at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor doing the Q&A after Steal This Story, Please. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, it's Nardwar, the human serviette, saying you're listening to CJSF
Burnaby and Dudulutu CJSF. Yeah.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.